This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Welcome to episode 20. Oh my gosh, we're finally out of the teens of the All Souls podcast. I'm Ginger.
I can't wait till we can drink. And I'm Summer.
So we're back. What are we doing? What are we doing this episode, Summer?
I think this is our potentially our wrap up of Comic-Con 2018 All Souls style.
Correct. And this episode, we're going to share our exclusive interview with Dev. It was just the three of us, me, Summer, and Dev, that we did during Comic-Con, as well as the audio of our roundtables with the cast and production of A Discovery of Witches TV. Now, we understand we did already share that audio on our Comic-Con Redux for our sister podcast, the Outlander podcast, because we cover everything. Whatever we do at Comic-Con, it just all goes out there. But here, since we had this very special interview, we haven't shared it anywhere yet. And we wanted to share our interview, but keep it Comic-Con, like A Discovery of Witches does Comic-Con. Actually, All Souls does Comic-Con. So we were there, and then Deb was there, and of course, the Discovery of Witches TV panel.
And if you ever want to know what it sounds like to hang out in a very loud restaurant while having a conversation about All Souls and the upcoming Times Convert with Deborah Harkness, we're going to give that to you because it was that loud.
our first interview with Deb, I think it was episode 2, although I could be mistaken, was in a cafe in Seattle. So that also had the ambiance going on. So,
but it didn't have me.
That's true. In a perfect world, obviously you'd control for audio and all that. But you know, when you get a chance to interview one of your favorite authors and you're going to a cafe, you say yes. And you bring all the recording devices. I think we had like 3 copies of this interview. My phone,
we
Summer's
absolutely
phone,
do.
And my in our digital recorder. So without further ado, here is our exclusive interview with author of the All Souls trilogy and the upcoming Times Convert, Deborah Harkness.
Yep. So how has Comic-Con been for you this year?
Comic-Con has been, this is my, I think my 3rd or 4th Comic-Con. Very different. Very different. Much more quick paced. And just, you know, as the series has kind of grown and changed, and now with the television production, it's just kind of growing and growing and growing. So it feels a little bit different. I used to be able to wander the floor a little bit more and just kind of hang, and that's a little bit more complicated now. So, but it's been really good, really positive trip.
And you have one panel left, correct?
You've done one panel. I've got the spotlight panel on tomorrow that I'm doing with somebody from Entertainment Weekly. So, yeah, yeah. That's good too. Yeah.
They have been. Somebody was saying that you were the pro at the panel. You were at the big panel for the Ballroom 20 yesterday. That you were the old hand at the everything, and you were walking everyone through it.
Yeah, basically, I was like, okay, is everybody? You know, Owen had been, but you know, it was the first time for Skye ever. Skye's never been to Comic-Con before. Yeah. And most of the other actors and actresses haven't done it. Alex has obviously done it. No one has done it. So it's just, I kept saying things like, is everybody hydrated? Is everybody have a granola bar? You know, because it's also really intense. And I think I've been telling everybody for a long time, you know, when you first meet the fans, it's going to be amazing. And when you just don't know how much they're ready to embrace you, and I think they're like, yeah, whatever, whatever. And then they felt it yesterday in the room, and I think they found it quite moving and kind of overwhelming and surprising. And you know, I was like, I wasn't overselling, I was telling you the truth. So hopefully they felt that too. So
when did you realize or decide, was it active or just something that slipped in and you're like, oh, okay, that's there, that your series, this All Souls world universe, would include time travel?
Well, I think it was pretty early on, back, like so early, it was still back when I thought it was going to be one book. I thought, because I know it, in retrospect it seems laughable, but again, naivete is beautiful. What happened was that I thought about this book, and since no one was ever going to read it but me, and it was just kind of me playing with things, and I wanted the first part of it to be more like a kind of a traditional romance arc, and I wanted the second part to be more historical, and I wanted the third part to be more science fiction. And I was like, wow, okay, well, but if I start in the present, how are you going to get back into the historical part? And at first, I think I thought, well, I guess I could have Matthew tell Diana his story. And then I thought, oh, but I don't want to go to the Middle Ages. I don't really, you know, it's not my thing. And so I was like, oh, but they could go back to my research period. And then I was just like, okay, time travel. We got to work that into the system of the world. Like, okay, guess there's time travel in this world. How would that work, and how would that fit in with everything else? So it was pretty early on, really.
And was it, once it was like, oh, okay, got it, it's there, was it obvious how it would happen? That Diana would be a walker, or how, I should say time walker, because we know what that means.
Yeah.
Like, not a GOT walker.
But yes. Not a jaywalker,
no.
A T-walker.
Yes, a T-walker.
It was because as a historian of science, one of the things I teach is, you know, Einstein's general theory of relativity and the challenges to it, and I find the multiverse theory of quantum mechanics just sort of fascinating, and it's never hardly ever what's on screen, because almost everybody wants to set up a time paradox, which is about, you know, how can you be in two places, and will you change the future by changing the past, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, okay, well, yeah, that's all dramatic, but who cares? I just want them to go back in time. Yeah. And be like, so, it was about sort of, once it was, I knew it was time, there was going to be time travel, then it was like coming up with a name for it, of what this actually meant. And I just sort of started talking about time walking, and then somebody said to me, no one's ever used that before. I was like, oh, come on. Somebody's used this before. And we looked. We could not find anybody else who used the term time walking. I mean, maybe somebody has and I didn't know about it. But all I wanted it to feel like nothing that was technological. I didn't want it to feel TARDIS-y or time machine-y. And so I liked it because it just was like you just step into the past and then you walk through it and then you walk out of it again. So it kind of fit that organic kind of desire of mine to make everything feel real
and seamless.
Yeah.
And not like, okay, this is where we stop and this is where we go. It was very like ready step.
Beautiful. which I think I would like to think if the theory was really right, and that we are in all of these parallel, infinite parallel universes, they must be really close. I just keep thinking like, okay, if that's really true, and like there is something exists, which is the version of today where, in fact, you got held, like, that there's another one of these interviews happening 5 minutes later because you got held up by the transformer over on the other side of the street, or you decided to have a drink and say, I'm going to be there. You know, that all of these possibilities are actually existing. They would have to exist really close together, and it would only take that step. Because I just, like, physics, I just can't imagine, like, it would happen at, like, a vast and enormous distance. But you'd have to travel, because if they're all happening simultaneously on different little strands, they'd have to be pretty darn close, I would think. So, anyway, yeah.
You said, during the tour for the paperback release of Book of Life, that choosing, you got a lot of questions like, okay, well, we have this, we're happy, but what's the next book? And you had said multiple times that the process of that choice, as you were kind of mooshing it all around in there,
yes,
was like having all those puppies.
I had a lot of puppies.
And choosing a puppy, like, how do you choose a puppy, right? Different days.
Right. I want them all.
Exactly.
Now.
And we do too. We all,
right, exactly.
So choosing, finally, a few things going on, years writing happens. Choosing was challenging because they were also cute, also looking over here, playing over here. How did Times Convert, or what would ultimately become Times Convert, those puppies or puppy, make its way through and claim your heart or your mind? How did they get through, and what do they look like?
So I had 6 puppies at the time. With a distant 7th puppy of knowing I wanted to write it. So I had the Marcus puppy, the Matthew puppy that is Serpent's Mirror. I had 4 completely unrelated puppies, and I had the Gallowglass puppy. And I was teaching a writing workshop at a wonderful writing retreat for women called Hedgebrook on Whidbey Island outside Seattle. And I started writing all of them. And it was like a dachshund race. And I would just be like, I feel like writing that one now. I feel like writing that one. Okay, I've written 2 lines of that. Now I want to write that. And I just kept going. And then as the week went on, it became more and more and more of Matthew's story and Marcus's story. And Matthew's story had the slight edge. And so I was like, okay, I think I'm writing this thing called Serpent's Mirror, and it's good. And that's what I'm going to do next. And I kept working on that for about 9 months, and I hit a surprise in Matthew's story that I had not anticipated, that struck me as incredibly authentic and incredibly true, and that I just was not prepared to tackle. And
I don't know what to say. I know this is not my interview, but I don't know what to say about that.
I know. And it was just like, oh crap, because the title had gotten leaked through nobody's fault. It just like somebody pushed a lever in an office and it uploaded as a future title because we started talking about it. And I was like, oh no, no, no. And I kept trying to push it and force it. The more I pushed it and forced it, the worse it got. I was like, okie dokie, Matthew puppy, go back. And, you know, like, you're going to doggy camp. And then I just started working on the Marcus book. So, and that, it just, like, I still work on Serpent's Mirror. And I, like, have started the Gallowglass. And I've got, like, another All Souls puppy going, as well as these other puppies. But honestly, the Marcus puppy just marked the Marcus book. And they've said, you got to stop calling it the Marcus book, because it's really not about Marcus solely. But like that was how it started. But then the story just was like, it sort of seamlessly became a year after the events of the Book of Life. And there were Matthew and Diana with 18-month-olds in it. And there was Phoebe going off to become a vampire. And there was Marcus sort of having all of the memories of his own experience of being a fledgling vampire coming back because his mate was about to go through this process. And it just became this like 3-stranded braid of a story that took us from like literally a year after the end of the Book of Life through that summer. And it was like, well, there it is. There's the story. And so in my head, it's still the Marcus puppy, but I really should stop calling it that.
Okay, thus far, take a little bit of a step forward into now stepping into Time Convert. Thus far, any vampire we've met that you've given us is already a vampire.
Yeah.
We haven't met someone who's going to do it. They're going to change. They've already been reborn. So the rebirth belongs to their history.
Right.
We meet Phoebe as a human. Times Convert is the first time your readers will see a beloved character reborn.
Uh-huh.
Summer laughed at me. Okay. She always cries.
That's okay. I do too. It doesn't make me uncomfortable.
No, good. Okay.
Seriously.
So what were the challenges and or surprises of writing Phoebe's rebirth in front of our eyes?
Have you guys read it?
No. No.
Oh my God. Okay. No. Okay. Well. So, I mean, what it was, so you asked that is because it sounded like you had read it.
Oh, no. I was about, my question comes from, this is, not that your other stuff isn't letting your heart out.
Yeah.
But this is like, oh gosh, not pressure, but it's a whole different animal.
Yeah. Well, it really, I mean, it was a total surprise to me because, like, she really wasn't supposed to be in the book. She really wasn't. And, you know, it was supposed to be about, like, Marcus talking about the 18th century. And, like, up pops Phoebe. And, I'm like, right? So it's like, you know, the night before Phoebe becomes a vampire and being forced to have this dinner party by Freya because she thinks it's, like, the correct thing to do. you know, Freya, who's like a medieval Danish princess, and thinks, like, we must have a banquet, you know? So here's this big banquet going on. Of course, like, Phoebe's, like, least interested right now in this whole thing. And Freya keeps saying, it's the last time you're going to get to eat this stuff. You should eat up. And it was just this amazing thing to be able to sit there and, like, imagine what that process would be like. And to do it without any kind of reference to the whole wide body of literature on becoming a vampire. Because my vampires aren't like anybody else's vampires, and therefore had experience of the, oh my God, and I'm dead, and I have to go sleep in a crypt, and none of that applies. So there, I was like, oh my God, what do you do on, like, day one vampire? What does day one of the vampire look like? So the Phoebe chapters in this book are literally, the chapter titles are numbers. So, like, it'll be chapter 13, 4, because it's her fourth day. And you get to track, because in my world, it turns out the very traditional way of raising a vampire was that for 90 days, that vampire went through a very kind of almost, like, ritualized process of sort of almost like, you know, I mean, we have lots of rituals around babies. Like, at what time does a baby get christened? At what time does a baby get circumcised? If they're, you know, we have lots of these things. I thought, well, they have to have this for vampires too. So 90 days, and which is 3 months, and you know, to watch Phoebe go through that 90-day period, and also explore, like, how are Diana and Matthew coping? How is Mark's? It was just amazing. And she, I think for most people reading the book, some of their favorite moments are moments with Phoebe, where she's just, like, in her own inimitable Phoebe way, dealing with the kind of, like, challenges of becoming a new vampire. So you have to remember, like, Phoebe, you know, how incredibly unflappable Phoebe was through all of the crises of the Book of Life. That's Phoebe. And so she takes that right into her life as a vampire, and it's just like, okay, you know, and just goes through. And it's really amazing. Like, what is the first feeding like? What is the first hunting trip like? What does it feel like to walk?
Who burps the vampire?
Who burps the vampire? You know, what does it feel like to take in all these other people's memories? You know, she's going to, the first blood she drinks will be her maker's blood. That means she's going to see all this stuff. And what is, so it was just, it was fascinating. I didn't expect any of it because I didn't expect her to be in the book.
Gracious.
What would you say is, so, I mean, the course of the first trilogy is like a year and a half, 2 years. What would you say with the span of Times Conquered in present time?
It goes from a day in May to right around the middle of August.
So it's going to basically be the 3 months.
Yeah.
Perfect.
The whole thing, yeah. So, yep. We get Phoebe from being made through the 90-day period before she's officially a fledgling vampire who's capable of feeding herself.
What have the challenges been of writing 18-month-olds? Now we've just discovered in your excerpt that was online last week, Weaver babies.
18-month-old Weaver babies are a whole new thing. Like, Phoebe did not, you know, things happened with those babies that I was like, where did that come from? From what part of my wacko brain did that come from? But yeah, like, the kind of, I kept thinking about these kids, and it was challenging to make them both interesting and age appropriate. They can't actually talk very much, so, like, what can be said is, like, extremely limited, and yet they're fairly mobile at 18 months. So it was, and mostly what I thought would be fascinating would be, like, actually watching Diana and Matthew cope with this. Much more interesting than the children themselves, who are just like happy being me, would be like the reactions of their parental units and grandparents and Baldwin and others to these situations. So, yeah, you know, and so what some of the events that, of course, happened between the middle of May and the middle of August in the All Souls universe include Matthew's birthday and Diana's birthday. So, you know, big family occasions at which 18-month-old Weaver babies could be an interesting feature. It was fun.
So you recently took a trip. You were abroad.
I was.
Did you find any inspiration on your trip abroad for future books?
I did. So this is my sort of modest goal at the minute is that I'm trying to... How can I say this? In my life as a writer, I have sort of three distinct phases, one of which is sort of researchy development, which takes a lot of time because it's very unpredictable where my journey is going to go. And then there's the writing process, which has a different set of predictability factors, but which essentially for me ends up being that it really takes me about between 9 and 12 months to write a book. And then there's the production process, which takes between 9 and 12 months. And what I've always done up till now is to do these things sequentially. So that I would be researching one book, and then I would be writing that book, then I'd produce that book, and then I'd start a new book. Now, I'm trying to have a book in research, a book in writing, and a book in production, so that in an attempt to get books out on a slightly quicker, it will never be fast, but a slightly quicker turnaround time. So I am writing another book while we are, getting Times Convert out in the world. And at the same time, I am starting to research the Gallowglass.
I was about to say, if you don't tell us, may I ask?
It's like, well, let me know when he meets a podcaster who lives in California.
Who's blonde.
And this is his mate that he is not yet.
And he
hasn't happened yet, but you never know. And believe me, you never know.
He's still available, ladies.
Yes. So it was a trip sailing all around Ireland to see Ireland as he would have seen it, which it would have been from the water.
Yeah.
And to kind of get into that and to make sure that I was giving him like the right entry point. Like I had ideas about where he would be and what he would be doing. And, but I was like, yeah, but you know, you should really make sure that, so it's been really interesting to just make that route and to take that tour, and to kind of to experience that. So, yeah.
And as you were traveling around by sea, did you, in order to get as up close and personal for that experience for Gallowglass.
Yeah.
Am I right that you weren't doing like big old cruise line? You were doing like smaller cruises? Or how did you decide
to arrange that? A regular cruise line. It wasn't
really?
Like a prime cruise. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mostly because it was a very first, I wanted to see as much as possible, as fast as possible, and I imagine I'll have to go back and do something that's much more targeted to be like, hi, you have a boat, it has two sails, and I need to get from here to there in this boat and feel what that feels like. But until I actually know what that place is, and I didn't want to kind of close that off. But, you know, it was just this kind of amazing thing where the place where I had the strongest feeling, like Gallowglass knew this place, was Iona. And that, so I'm like frantically reading on the way home on the plane about Iona, and come to find out that one of the names that Gallowglass has is a very traditional Western Isles name, Sorley, that is linked to a particular family, and it is that family that built the abbey on Iona. I was like, oh.
And this is after you named him. After he named himself.
And after I showed up at Iona, having done, I named him, I gave him a name that is associated with Stornoway in that place, and I picked that name, and I was like, okay, somehow he's connected to this family, albeit, you know, by hundreds of years have passed since the great, you know, since Iona was built at this point, but the fact that I'm reading up on the Abbey and find out that his family is connected to it, and that was the place, the single place where I was like, hourglass was definitely here. It was just like, and his ancestors are buried in the graveyard. So it's just, flippy. So, yeah, so I want to spend time in a small boat on around Iona, I think, for a little bit. But.
Small boats are always safer than small planes.
Exactly.
Yes. If getting or segueing into your nonfiction, your life, your first love, I guess, history, your passion and your expertise, have you done any online courses that have been on offer or available to students outside USC or outside of the university that you're teaching at that moment that you're contracted with?
So I'm a full professor at USC. So USC does not have online teaching.
Okay.
And as I have never done an online course, and I cannot imagine ever doing an online course.
Okay.
Part of the reason for that is that for me, I'm a really big believer in sort of contact between faculty and students. I would find that really, really tough not to be able to like sit down in a room with one of my students and be able to like really talk to them and really see them and really have an ongoing set of. So, yeah. So I'd have to really wrap my head around that, and then it would have to be a USC offered course, and they don't offer.
Oh, fair enough.
So there's that.
So we're thinking something like a MOOC, a massive open online course, which obviously would be even like that to the nth degree, right? Which is even less possible contact, right? But yeah, something. I guess it wouldn't be a course then, but more of a presentation.
Yes, that's the thing. It would be about delivering content.
Yeah.
And for me, I think I can probably deliver just as much content as effectively in my novels as I could in a MOOC.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that's the thing.
Absolutely.
I mean, one of the things you guys have to realize is you're actually getting state-of-the-art history.
Mm-hmm.
When you're reading about the 18th century in Marcus's books, you're not getting like the razzmatazz Hollywood version of this. You're getting like the arguments and conversations historians are having about family and how did people live. What was it like to be on the frontier in the revolution as opposed to in a big city like Boston? And whose revolution was this really? And all the things, it's not like, you know, actually nobody in Boston, the Boston papers were completely uninterested in what was happening in Philadelphia on July 4th in 1776. You know, they were interested in something else entirely. The Continental Army was complete chaos for the longest time because none of the state militias had signed on to the Continental Army and did not want to share with other Continental militias. And so they were like in camps by states, and no one would listen to anybody who didn't come from their state. Nobody from Connecticut would see a Massachusetts doctor because they were like, we're here fighting for Connecticut. We're not here to fight for Massachusetts. And so, like, this is not what you see, right? So I feel like I've got that chance to deliver that kind of content. It's just that hopefully it slipped in and be like, wait a minute, I don't remember hearing that from history classes.
And that happens? And thus make someone ask that question and say, oh, okay, now, what is that about? And then go find a reference.
Go find a MOOC.
Yep.
Go find a good history book, because I always give you guys reading lists for books that you want.
A ton.
And then to be able to, like, delve into that and be able to kind of feel like you're not drowning in that material. Because, like, if you go to a bookstore and, like, there's the Revolutionary War shelf, where do you start?
Yeah.
Whereas this is a way to be like, I didn't even know I could be interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I am. So that's kind of like, I feel, is my thing.
You already are. Is what you're saying. You really already are offering this.
A MOOC in every book. That's going to be my new motto. A MOOC in every book.
But it's better than a MOOC because it is passive learning. You don't even know you're learning it.
That's the best
it's like
time.
Osmosis.
It's the best time. I always say, man, if I could get my students to read any book I assign them as closely as you all read the Allsall's Trilogy, I'd be made in the shade as an educator. I would have, my classes would swing. But that's, you know, as soon as it's like, a course. Like, you start taking it seriously and it becomes a responsibility and whatever. Whereas what I want you to feel is like, oh my God, that was so much fun. I learned so much. I didn't even know I learned about whatever it was. And it felt effortless and painless. And that's pretty great. I would love that. I would
it's
love
kind of
that.
Kind of magic,
you think?
I think maybe. I mean, why not?
That would make me happy.
I mean, it kind of like, I guess it's Deb's magic. Or it's a very good writer's magic, but still. It's magic within a magical trilogy, a magical series.
Right, right.
Yeah. See, I think you call yourself a demon, but you are a bit of a weaver as well.
Yeah.
I can live with being a weaver, which is a little of everything.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it, a weaver? A very long-lived witch who's very creative. Which, you know, I mean, that's a little demon DNA, a little witch DNA. I can live with that.
Speaking of a little witch DNA, if you had enough to do this, if you could set or make, write, chant one spell to do something practical and practical, whatever it would be, say, around your house or in your life, what would that one spell be?
I am of a certain age where good health would be the one that would be the spell that I would most want. Because I would want to use it on everybody I loved. And my mom is now 79, almost 80. I've got friends who are raising children. And, you know, I'm starting to get the creaky joints and, you know, and the endless summer of hot flashes. And I just think, wow, wouldn't it be awesome to just have health? Because you just don't realize until you don't have it anymore how much is dependent on good health. So that would be the one. That would be the winner, I think, of all spells. Because with that, you could do almost anything. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And I've also got a cold right now. And so
that's
totally what I'm hoping for.
Help. So if you didn't have a cold, it would be to have somebody clean your house. House cleaning spell. I would love that, personally.
A house cleaning spell?
Yeah. Or a house to clean. I want a bishop house.
Like a self-cleaning house. Yeah, like a self-cleaning oven.
All of them. But self-cleaning ovens aren't really self-cleaning.
They're
That's
not.
A misnomer.
They're totally not. I cooked something in my brand new self-cleaning oven because I was so totally psyched that I had a self-cleaning oven for the first time. And it was hell. There was a lot. First of all, it made the whole house smell. And then you needed to actually have a professional cleaning service come in and like deodorize your house because everything smelled charred. But yeah, no, totally.
Yeah. Well, I think to wind down, a question of, and I know that Times Convert is done, but it's still in our future because it's coming out to fans,
right?
To readers. So that is future, but you're like 99.9% of your work, except for traveling and signings and tours, is done. So it's like the birth has happened. We're waiting to bring it out to present it to the public.
That's right.
And you said you have a few things going on at different stages. You're working on that in that way now. If we could ask along those lines for the adaptation, are there plans to, or are you at liberty to say, is there interest now that we're about to have, the UK is about to have its premiere, and then the two distributors' networks have been announced for the US, and they're going to come out in January. Has there been interest or talk or movement toward something for adapting possibly another book?
So another book in the series?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the deal. So Bad Wolf owns the adaptation rights for the trilogy.
Okay.
So it was always their hope, plan, desire, dream to be able to adapt all three books of the trilogy. Sky certainly took on that on board when they did, and so did Sundance. Which, again, like, to understand, like, I think people are a little unclear about this. So, the AMC Networks owns, so AMC of Mad Men, The Walking Dead, all that stuff, owns Sundance Now. Sundance Now, it sounds like that is the streaming service for Sundance. It is actually the streaming service for AMC. So it is AMC's streaming platform. And Shudder is the streaming platform for AMC that is devoted to sci-fi, fantasy, horror, etc. And then there is also, in AMC's TV network, the Sundance Channel. So when AMC took on this purchase, they took it on with a kind of look of it of being like, it can stream on Shudder, it can stream on Now TV, where we've got this Sundance Now, where we've got this amazing, like they do a lot of British drama and crime procedurals and stuff. And their plans are to sort of way amp up the streaming service side, as all networks are. Everybody, this is everybody's game. So we are like that. We're leading that thing. And then at some point, it will. They also hope it will show, you know, on Sundance, the Sundance Channel. So everybody's interested in more than one series. So, and we have already started having development meetings for Series 2.
Will they all remain under a Discovery of Witches as
it'll
a moniker?
All be as a, so it'll yeah. still be Discovery of Witches, but Series 2 would cover the action in Shadow of Night.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's what we're now discussing. So I went to the first one of those in May, where we were discussing, like, you know, going to do this, what are we going to do here, what about this problem, just the very early stages of like, ooh, you know, are we going to build London or are we, because you know, are we going to go find a field and build like London? I mean, these are people who are fearless. If they measured the Bodleian and rebuilt the Bodleian, they're
down to three inches,
I think,
and the wood grain
on the columns, was recognizable.
Gracious.
I was like, that's the third one over from the doorway. So it has a very distinctive and unusual wood grain that's not like the others. There's this like pale line through it. Unbelievable. So, so, you know, that's the level at which they've got to start like thinking, conceptualizing. Because it has to do with things like space. Like, you and I aren't thinking like, do we have storage space for that? But they've, you know, they can't just like build it out. I mean, they've got to like pre-build it and have room to pre-build it, then have room to store the pre-build, then have everything ready, because it's not like they can just start like building now and be ready for film. It's got to be like, it is such a logistical, I had no idea.
As part of the early planning, has it been too early yet to start, not blocking, but like mapping out the taking the book and chunking it up.
There's been a lot of chunking it up. I was not involved in the chunking it up because I was finishing up with Times Convert. But that's fine. There's the book. We have the first season where, you know, we're all up and running. Everybody's in. It's a totally different experience than getting the series started, where it feels a lot, you know, there's a lot more fits and starts and, oh, God, we just hit a wall and we didn't expect to hit that wall and now what do we do? You know, now we've kind of got, we're up and running and moving, and I think our confidence is high, and we've had this kind of great experience, and we all really like each other, and so it's just a very, very different kind of feeling. So, yeah, definitely chunking it up and thinking about practicalities and making sure that there's space and that there's, you know, studio available and all that kind of great stuff. So we're at the very early stages, but really hopeful. And so then it'll just depend on how people respond and how people react. And but hopefully it will all go well.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
I just want you to know that right after your panel in the Ballroom 20 yesterday, we went down to go get Times Convert bags. And a woman walked up behind us and was like, I just came from this panel and I've never heard of it, but I really want all the books. I want to buy the books now. And they were like, we're all out of the first book, but we can only sell it as the trilogy. And she was like, okay, and bought the whole thing, like sight unseen, based on just that panel. So I think excitement is high. I think you guys did amazing.
Oh, good.
And I know that we're going to be pushing to get everyone to go and do what needs to be done to get it happening.
I mean, I think it's one of the best adaptations I've ever seen of a book. I really do. I will absolutely say that hands down. I mean, it's incredibly faithful to the spirit and the whole...
And the columns.
And the columns. But just to the whole thing. I mean, it feels right to me. It feels like my characters and my story. There's no point at which I'm like, that doesn't feel right. And that's, I mean, how can you ask for more in an adaptation? I just think, you know, I think they did an awesome job. And it was not an easy job to take a book of that length and complexity on which future books are also based.
Yeah.
Because one of the challenges was just, oh my God, wait a minute. We have to put that in season one because we're going to deploy it in series two. You know, so things that you would have cut out for some reason, you then think, nope, we can't do that. We have to put it back in. So it was not an easy task, but I think I'm really glad to hear that people's reactions are as positive as I really expected them to be, but you never know.
Even, and I promise you I'll close with this, but even before the roundtable, it was when we were seeing the clips.
Yeah.
Just, even though we all know, hopefully, dear listener, you've read the books, but we all know who and what Peter Knox is and what he does and all that. And Owen Teal seems a very lovely gentleman.
He's lovely.
But even seeing those clips and him, you know, obviously knowing he's acting, but seeing him really embody Peter Knox in those short clips, like when they did the up close and they said, oh, who was the name? Diana Bishop. My goosebumps had goosebumps, which had goosebumps.
I know.
My whole
How
like,
do
I
they
felt
do
flush.
That?
Well, it's acting, yes, but it was because I knew his reaction and, oh, hockey sticks. Someone's just, you know, not really, but like signed someone's wants to sign Diana's death certificate. I mean,
yeah.
All that, you're like, because you know what's you're like, this is where it starts. Holy crap, this is where
and,
he takes off.
And just go back to the point of adaptation, right? That's not in the books.
No.
Right?
I just want to say that, right? Because everybody's so freaking worried that, oh my God, it's not in the book. And what you're talking about is something that is not in the books. And you got to see it. And yet, obviously, there was that moment where he put two and two together and made four. It happens. And the great privilege we have now with this TV adaptation is you get to see it.
Seeing Satu there being his like
hard
muscle, jaw on the floor. I'm like, oh my!
And
you
ain't seen nothing.
Oh, I believe you. She is gorgeous, and I'm sure she's the sweetest. She scares the crap out of me just looking at her. She's gorgeous, but she.
Wait till you see her and Teresa Palmer go head toe to toe.
Oh man.
I mean, just think about that person and Diana in La Pierre.
I can't. And I can't in the Oubliette either. I can't.
Because that's the thing is that, like, you guys went through the whole series empathizing and identifying with Diana. And what this TV show gives us the opportunity to do is to see this story from every other character's point of view as well. And so it really is, it's like the supersized, supercharged version of a story you love. And if you can embrace it as that, as like, oh my God, we're getting to peek behind the curtain and open the closets and look under the tables of this story we know so well, and we're going to be surprised and have revelations every step of the way, we're going to have an amazing time. But if it's like, if you start being like, that wasn't in the book, and that, no, there's going to be a lot of really great stuff that wasn't in the book. The best stuff sometimes in this TV series is what wasn't in the book. So I'm really glad. That
well,
means a
thanks.
Lot to me.
Oh, no, it means so much to us. And thank you so much that we've gone over time. I apologize.
That's okay.
But,
I don't mind if you don't mind. Call it a bonus podcast.
A bonus news. Totally.
Thanks for having me, you guys. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my gosh. That was so much fun. Summer, what was it like finally meeting her and saying hi to her?
I had met her before. I just didn't have a recording of it.
Being part of the interview.
We've just, we, Deb and I just have never been on our best behavior together because we were being recorded. The times that I've had with Deb in the past have been completely off the record and still lovely. But it was nice to have the time to really ask questions of things that, you know, you don't have time to do in your quick meet and greets.
Oh, of course not. Yeah, that's not a time for an interview. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
So that was so much fun. And now we're going to be sharing the audio from the press roundtables at Comic-Con for Discovery of Witches TV.
The unconditional love and acceptance.
Yes.
Of the Bishop clan.
Yes.
As it stands now.
Yes.
She softens Sarah.
Yes.
Were you able to draw from someone or something or some experience in your personal life to bring that quality of M to a Discovery of Witches?
Well, funny enough, as out of all the characters I've ever played, this is the closest to me. I'm not a lesbian and I'm not a witch, but everything else M is, that's who I am. And because usually the characters I play are the bitch. or the strong, you know, minded, you know, headness and stuff like that. Actually, I play the Sarah type of character more than I play Anne, and so this was a challenge for me. But this is who I really am as Valerie. So it was very easy for me to draw.
She knits.
And I knit. Oh my god!
Wait, in real life?
In real life?
Oh my god! Yeah. I have so my knitting. Knitting. Uh-huh. Oh my god!
So the set is covered in her knitting.
Oh my god! And I came back and I've knitted like 3 sweaters, a hat, glove, and 2 scarves.
Yeah.
Since February. And I'm on a coat
have
now.
Your own Bishop house.
Yes.
Oh, and she had these fabulous bamboo wooden knitting needles that she'd found. That she sourced them. She found them in Wales.
Yes.
So she said, this is what M's knitting needles would be like. And yes, then off she went.
In Afghan and was on set.
And Alex, what did you bring personally to the role?
Yeah, I didn't knit. I didn't bring anything. What I
needle point?
No. I didn't do that. But what actually I did, it was interesting because M is, she can still work spells, whereas and is a librarian, and Sarah is basically we decided Sarah was working. She'd go to the markets, like farmers markets, and sell her soaps and her body lotions, and you know it was sort of more like that. But what we did. We did it together. In reading the book, you know, Deborah is so good at sort of describing how Matthew smells and how Teresa smells to Matthew. And she, you know, she described Diana. She describes Diana as smelling like willow sap. He smells willow sap and chamomile and frankincense and all these things. And so I, at the beginning of filming, I'd only just met Valerie, and we hadn't met Teresa or Matthew yet. We hadn't shot any scenes with them. And we had a couple of days off, and so I said, why don't we go to Neil's yard, and I want to create the smells. Because I was wearing my own scent that I felt was how Sarah smelled and how she would smell to Matthew, and that was all very fennelly, aniseedy, and that's what I wore. And so I thought it would be great if the actors, whenever they come onto set, they have this sort of just like aura of scent around them, which is particular to their species and to their personality. So we had a fantastic day at Neil's Yard Remedies making all of these potions.
And that's with you. That's what you're good at.
And that's what Sarah's good at.
Sarah is good at.
And so we made these two little potions, one for Matthew and one for Teresa, which was their species particular character smells, and we gave them to them. And then Valerie, she made up her smell, and that's then what. So we were all wearing our smells then when we were filming.
How fun!
Yeah.
Okay. So when this project came to you both, what was it about the characters that made you feel, this is it? I have to be a part of this.
Well, when you were talking about when you read that they gave you the first 3 episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I just had for my audition, impression I just had of like two scenes. I didn't read the books, so I didn't know any of the history or whatever. I just had these two incredible scenes and her humanity. So yes, we're creatures, we're vampires, we're the demons and the witches, and we're very separate and we should not mix. But as M is, it's like you should be able to tolerate and get along with everyone. And that was already written in these beautiful scenes. And so I was like, there's no way I'm not going to do this project if I get hired. Please God hire me to do it. And they did.
Is the scene you auditioned with in the pilot?
Yes, it is. Things, a couple of little things are changed, but yes.
Can you give us a hint what it was so we can like be excited about it when we see it?
Do you have the footage on your phone? Just pull it up.
Yeah, because it was a self-tape, and I like my friend taped it. I should have kept it. Oh, I erased it. Oh my God, I can't remember. Alex asked, answer the question, and then I'll tell you what scene it was because it's the kind of melded together.
So. Yeah, I mean, I sort of answered the question in the panel, but I mean, what drew me was basically just reading the episodes, the three episodes that we were given, and as I said, in the first three episodes, our characters don't really appear strongly. They actually the world of the creatures comes to Madison later on in the series, and that's then when you see the world, really the world of Sarah and Em, and see how they engage and also how they have to deal with these creatures sort of basically entering into their space. But as I said, I had to just trust that this was going to go forward for me and for Valerie. You know, as an actor, if you're going to commit to 6 months of a year, you want to know that those 6 months are going to be ones that you feel fulfilled in doing, you know, it creatively. It was great. And as far as we know, it's going to just build from there. Certainly, I know book two is... It's very different, and in book two, our characters don't appear, but the second series is going to work differently, so that you have the parallel worlds going on at the same time, so that you know
parallel timelines,
so that you know what's going on with us in the contemporary world.
Very nice. And that's actually something that you can't, well, Deb could have chosen to show that in the book, but since she doesn't, and we want to keep these really important characters, that's such a way to visually keep those characters included and weave them into the story.
Yes, and you can't have an entire series without them, because people will lose interest. So you have to keep those worlds still very much alive in the fans' consciousness. Actually,
in creating your characters, what was the biggest challenge and how did you overcome it?
I don't know, there was no challenge.
No challenge at all.
I mean, like as I said before, I'm so used to playing her type of character as an actor. So, you know, being the nice girl is not that easy. Uh-huh. The bad, I don't know why. Not that you're a bad girl by no means. It's just her energy is what I usually play. That type of energy of Sarah I usually play. And
I think also what was actually rather nice was, you know, we're the aunts. We're ladies of a certain age, and it was actually really nice to not have to sort of be sort of squeezed into something, and you know, I could go around in my dungarees and my Birkenstocks and socks, and sort of like didn't matter, you know, I could go around not needing to wear makeup and not needing to sort of have to look glam or whatever. So it was actually a real relief.
It really is. Yeah, once you get over like, oh my
once
god,
you get
not,
over
can't wear any
like,
makeup, give me a lash.
Yeah,
Yeah, then it was fantastic.
Great.
Oh, and to quickly go back, I thought about the scene. So I think it's in episode 4.
Okay.
And it's, have you read the books?
Yeah.
Okay, so you all know. It's when we find out that she's falling in love with this vampire. And we're telling her, you've got to be careful, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. It's that scene. It's totally changed from what I ended up doing as far as the dialogue and what the scene was for the audition, because the audition, they'll do more so you can flesh out to see what kind of humanity I'm going to bring to him.
Yeah.
And so we'll shorten a little bit. But yeah, in episode 4 is when we find out that she's in love.
We know obviously the Book of Spells is the big object that everyone is after in the series, but if you, in your magical set that you mentioned in the panel, do you think there's one particular object that your character would be drawn to that, let's say if there was a fire, they would grab and rescue?
Besides Tabitha.
Yeah.
Besides
of course.
That's not easy, actually. I mean, it's a book that is our Book of Spells, that has been passed down from generation to generation within the Bishop family, and that is the book that Sarah draws on all the time. And so actually, if I had to grab something, it would be that, because it's actually our family history.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would probably do my knitting. I would. But also, you know, personal stuff that I know that she gave me.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. There are like a few items,
and we take when later in the book, because you've already, you know what happens when Sarah and Em have to leave. Of course, you mustn't say this because it's spoilersy things. But when they have to leave their home, they have to leave their home. When we were filming it, we had suitcases and we were running in and out and filling up on the back of our wagon, and then again our designers, our house was so beautiful, and they had all these gorgeous sort of mobiles that we'd obviously made, and they were all hanging and tinkling on the porch and everything, and I just grabbed, because it had always been there, sort of just moving in the wind, this one particular mobile, and I grabbed it, and I just thought, I have to take this with me, because this is our house. And I thought, this is the last thing that Diana's mother made. You know, I had a memory of them sitting, Sarah sitting with her on the porch, and she just did this thing with some dried oranges and stuff like that, just hung it up, but it was sort of, so it was holding on to her as well and connecting with her. And I'm hoping that if we do, then eventually when you see us at Isabeau de Clermont's set tours, I'm hoping that the first shot we have is of Sarah still holding the mobile. Wild hair. Yeah.
But I just have to do the sidebar, because I'm such a fan of hers anyway. But as an actor, what a delicious thing to do. Because so when she... don't want to well up, because I just remember the scene so well, and it just touched us. And when she didn't tell me she was going to do it, whatever, and just the way you grabbed it and took it, and it was just, oh my God. And that's a tribute to how brilliant she is. And I'm telling you, you guys have no idea what an honor it is to be with her. It really is. I mean, because I'm such a fan. I'm such a fan. And it was just those little things, you know what I mean? And all the actors, just what they brought to the table. I would sit and go, especially, you know, towards the end, like episode 7 and 8, when we had all the people descend on that area, and you get to watch these brilliant actors do their thing and what they bring to what you've read, and it's like, oh my God, it just leaps off the page.
We had a very funny moment when it was a scene where we had a sort of like a dinner, and it was all of the creatures, and it's kind of towards the end of the show, really, and I felt that shooting this scene, I knew this was the last day possible day where we were actually all going to be together as actors.
Yes.
And we were sitting having a meal, and they were setting up and lighting, and so, and there were sort of nuts and all sorts of stuff on the table to nibble, and so we were kind of like laughing and chatting, whatever. And I decided just before they said action, and I don't even know why I did it, I think it was so stupid, I decided to get up and to kind of like to propose a toast as Alex to the company, and I wanted to just say how much I had loved working with everybody and how special this was and how important everybody was to each other, and I got so much, I burst into tears. And then they called action because the director, I wasn't aware, and I was then supposed to do a toast as Sarah, and I stood up and I just went burst into tears. And the director was like, what the hell, what was going on? But I'd gotten so emotionally kind of, I was just, it was a bit much.
Well, it's a tribute too.
But it's true also, because we have all gone on this journey for 6 months together. And it's also, it's a journey where you know you're taking this story, which is precious because it's Deborah's creation. It's her baby. And she's allowed us to hold that baby and to go forward with that baby. And that's a real honor, and you can't take it for granted, and you mustn't disrespect that. And so it was sort of very, I just felt it was very important to make everybody feel like we are family.
Did it spark your interest a little bit?
Oh my gosh, I want more. The U.S. premiere date.
Look, we gave you the broadcaster.
I know.
You guys.
We're just, you know.
With the whole thing, right?
Yes.
How exciting was that to go on with AMC and Sundance Now?
Yeah.
For me, what is huge is that I'm getting it too, because as an actor in something as big as this, and I mean, as you were saying earlier, if it was made into a film, you'd never have the time to create all these worlds. And that's a great thing that's happened with television. And, you know, it was a wonderful thing to be part of that with Thrones, that you could be part of a story that could grow over years, is that you often, as an actor, you just look after your bit of the story. Obviously, that's my job. But to be here today is to feel the whole thing, and to feel the energy and the passion that it starts to bring up, and that it's relating to people in a room. And there's a lot of people in the room. I wasn't expecting that, because it's a new show. I mean, I knew that the book had followers, but boy, you know, there's a lot of people there. And I've got a real energy surge from this.
Yeah. So I always say, hopefully you're just sort of, you know, for the cast and the crew, I said, you know, you guys don't understand. There's a lot of people out there who are already in love with this and who are ready for this. And it is, it was so exciting to get the news about Sundance and being part of the Sundance family. I think Sundance has stood so long for a kind of independent vision and a commitment to telling stories that nobody else is telling. And I feel like it's the perfect home for this project, and that it will, you know, because we really did not fall into a lot of genre tropes. We were kind of, you know, fighting against that, you know, the fangs, the pale makeup, the whatever, you know, to make it. And a lot of networks would have been like, could you make it a little bit?
Yeah.
You know?
Because it's worked before, we were talking about it, you know, there's
we know this works. We're not sure if anybody's
going to. Yeah.
And so, but I think Sundance has such integrity in terms of that I'm absolutely through. Thrilled. Mostly I'm just thrilled we could tell you.
Because it's been like, how long did you have to keep it a secret? Sorry.
No.
I like two-parted on it. How long did you have to keep it a secret?
When did they tell you?
I got an email from Jane, the great Jane Tranter. 3 days ago.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I've known a little longer than that, but I think it's the kind of thing where, you know, there was considerable interest, and what Sundance, the place that Sundance wants to give it, and the kind of prominence it wants to give it, and the way it is comfortable with the direction the show's going, was just made it all, you know, fit into place. And then there's just lots of days where lawyers talk to each other, and so, you know, and you're just thinking,
has anybody told them when Comic-Con is? You know, can we get it? So it's been a little nerve-wracking. So yeah, I'm a little long about that.
Oh, and I'd love to ask about your character, because as you've played a villain before, like on Game of Thrones, what sets Peter apart from previous villains you've played, and what do you like most about playing?
Well, he's his own character, and it's from the writing of Deb and then being able to allow it to work in it and to bring forth. It's something that I want, whatever I'm allowed to. And then you collaborate. So I'm not really worried about Peter like that. But what I would say is that there was something I was looking for that I discovered that happened with Thrones, and that has happened on this, is that Sir Alistair was a mean character, but you understood why he was a mean character. You were allowed to walk a certain amount of time in his shoes through the show. He had enough dialogue to Jon Snow to say why he was cynical about the world and how you just can't open it. It's not human nature to expect empathy, to expect a sense of good prevailing. It's not in. It's because survival is a stronger force, and that means it will be more live and let die. I never saw him. Maybe at the beginning I was worried that he could be just like, he's on repeat. He just hates Jon Snow for no apparent reason. But they began to write better and better for me, I felt. And that was a gift. Well, whereas with this, straight off, the quality of which I hope came across in the panel, he is fighting for a cause that he utterly believes in, and his ways along the way may be pretty mean. The tactics that he will use to manipulate people. But that's what goes on in the world. And because he's got a clear goal, and that may, you know, that's a populist. If you think about this thing about populism, it's often what unites people through a negative. And he's guilty of that. He is trying to unite his species against the vampires for, as he sees it, the oppression, because they've lived 1500 years. They've, you know, he go on all day about it. That he is trying to unite people to fight that, to put it back, and that is a raison d'être. And he realizes that his life is, you know, he's a man of a certain age. That to me was irresistible, because I know that I'm going to be. All the work that I put in, not everything will, because you haven't got time for everything, but you will manage to bring something together, and the quintessence of that man will be pretty close while he's in this season, however long that may be, which is wonderful. He will be pretty close to the action, and so as an actor you don't feel marginalized, and then you just go, I'm in, you know, that's, you know, there's enough things ticked now that I'm just thrilled to be part of this.
I think one of the things that it was amazing on that in the trailer, the shot from the trailer, you could just see when he heard Diana Fisher's name, that the look in his eyes.
Yeah, exactly.
Chills.
And
because,
the score was great too.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my goodness, but just like that whole personal history of
For those who know the book, there's a huge...
You could just see that name triggered something in him that made you suddenly want to know why he was the way he was.
Exactly.
And that's what, you know, again, sometimes the most interesting people that you meet in life are not the ones that you immediately warm to and think, I like you.
Yeah,
know, it's the ones who have those layers that you want to get to know. So, no cartoonish villain, for sure.
No.
Speaking of no cartoonish villain, and with how you just described kind of the experience of approaching Peter Knox, as you portrayed and adapted Peter Knox for television, did you find challenges and surprises? And what were maybe one or two of each?
I think that the integrity of it was a surprise, that it bore that analysis. And then my respect, you know, grew for the writer. That journey started to happen. It was a bit of a surprise, because you think, well, we need a negative person, because that's where you'll get the drama. You know, you've got the person you want to root for that is going to survive against these odds. But we need those odds to be very, very strong, you know. And there is a lot of it about. There's a lot of strong arm politics going on. Like we've stripped away years of democracy is going on. You know, I don't want to go down any obvious routes here that people that come to mind that's going on right now.
But, we apologize. Well, as a country, we apologize.
Well, we've got our own. You know, it is a bit of a state of flux. Let's just say that at the moment. I hope, and it will come out. You know, it'll go through a period of change. So he surprised me, and one of the things that also really at first I didn't like, and then I said, but this is a wonderful story, is that he's not as talented as the others. They're just so gifted. They're given it from birth. You know, she can do anything. And she beats me up just because she gets angry with me. And I don't know if we can use all this, but she invokes this thing called witch wind. And knowing that we had, basically, that Deb had entrusted this series to people who had the wherewithal, That's what I've experienced a lot, in especially in my earlier career, is people sitting down and having great ideas, but they just don't have the budget to do it. Because time costs. And you haven't got the time to do it, and you compromise, and it's like, what happened to that? You said it would be an incredible chase of life and death across continents, and it turns out to be a conversation in a pub. You know? What happened? So, I just feel more and more excited to be here today and, you know, sharing this moment.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting and chilling for me as a historian is you have to remember, I wrote these books a decade ago. And I feel like in some ways they're more timely than they were when they were written. But as a historian, what I know is that any period of expansion, and we had expanded in all sorts of ways. There, you know, I wrote this in the shadow of the Prop 8 debate here in California about gay marriage, which was, you know, overturned. And people said, well, where is this coming from? And I thought, my little historian bells went off. And I thought, we're about to enter into this drawing back phase. And so when I wrote this, you know, what I find weird watching it now is I'm thinking, weirdly, this seems in chilling ways more relevant and more like on point politically than it might have seemed in 2011 when people first read it.
How interesting.
So because it's...
I don't mean
no, no, go.
You know, obviously, as an author, one of the biggest thrills can be seeing your vision come to life on screen.
Yeah.
But we also know that there are things that we, you know, tend to be very particular about. Was there anything that you were very firmly wanting to make sure stayed in the series, and something that maybe you gave them a little creative license for, and really was kind of surprised and pleasantly in how it turned out?
Good questions. We had a lot of, to kind of follow up on what Owen was saying, we had a lot of conversations about what we could do well and what we might want to leave to the reader's imagination. So there is a favorite scene of mine that was about creature yoga, about what would happen if vampires, witches, and demons, like we're doing a peace project that involved yoga together. And I loved, the scene was daft, and I loved writing it. And people loved the scene, and it's like, oh, I love the scene. And when we sat down, like, to talk through what we were going to do, we all looked at each other and thought, okay, that could end badly, you know? And so we all kind of took a pinky pact, and it was a courageous one to say, if we don't have the confidence to know we can do that well, let's just not do it. Let's leave that to the readers and the imagination. So, on the one hand, I'm sorry to not see it, but on the other hand, I'm kind of like relieved we made that decision, because then we could focus on doing other things, like making the library. I was really, really worried about the Bodleian. When they said to me, we're going to build the Bodleian in a studio, I just thought,
Okay, this has got disaster written on it.
Yeah.
Letters 35 feet tall. You can't rebuild the Bodleian. It was built in 1602. It's
Did
not
they take
going
from
to
other sets or anything? Or is it completely...
They went in. They got permission to go in with, like, electronic measurers. They measured every inch of Duke Humphreys and the Seldonet. And they rebuilt it within, I believe, 3 inches. They ran. They were 3 inches short. And... The keeper of rare books, the Bodley's librarian, came to the set and walked in and went, and that's what I did. I mean,
isn't that great?
So I was like, why are we not going on location? The real reason was we could film on Sundays between like 4 and 8, and only 25 people could be in the library at the same time. That included the camera and the camera people and the cast. So it was impossible. You think of your Witch Wind scene. How could we have ever have done that?
Yeah.
So they're like, we're going to just build it. I was like, I mean, you can imagine somebody who's worked in there, you know, for most of her adult life, and I'm thinking this is going to be horrible. And I walked in and I said, and there was a wooden cube, and I said, that is a column base from Selden End. And they said, yeah, it is. And I said, I can tell you which column base that is, because I sat next to it for an entire year doing my just, I could tell from the grain of wood on the oak that they had simulated. So that was just like, it was incredible. Now, had that authenticity.
There's another thing which is amazing. James North, the production designer, is a young guy. Well, he looks very young, but he's a young guy. When the sets were done with, he has the ability to see in a set. I think when he did this, they have to strike the Bodleian, and no matter, he could see that those columns would be useful because they have, a lot of it is set in Venice as well, that he would be able to have the artistic vision to look at something and lift it out of context, take it into another set, and build a whole courtyard at the congregation. Incredible.
So the Bodleian columns got marbleized and then put in the courtyard of the congregation set. So he was just—he was a genius, and so that's the kind of thing. I can't hammer a nail, so there's no way for me to imagine that. But it was just breathtaking. And you would walk. I would literally. And when I walked on the set of the Bishop House, I said, "Can I?" I said, "We should keep this on the soundstage and use it as an Airbnb."
Oh, and there's another one, right? Right. I'm not sure you were there. Very early on in the story, there's a real super witch as well, who's Maverick. She's rogue.
Satu.
Yeah. And the discovery of where is very early on in the show, of revealing where she lives. And there's a lake in Wales, not that far from Cardiff, with pine trees, and you suddenly feel we're not in the UK now. We've gone much further north with Denmark going up. It could be, it's like those pictures you see near the Arctic Circle. It gets kind of a bit more barren with just these really strong trees. And they built a boathouse over the water, and that's where she lives, this old rickety old thing.
And it just looks
it
like
is so Finland. Fantastic. I couldn't... Yeah. I said, what are you going to do? They said, we've got to take it down. We have to leave. I said, you can't take this down.
We want to live here.
It's incredible. I want to come here on holidays.
I was going to ask you a quick question
so
before
sorry,
you guys leave. Just what was your favorite film or scene as an actor to film?
It has to be Witch Wind. Yeah. I thought about it. Yeah, I've been asked this. Yes. I don't want to spoil anything, but it has to be Witch Wind.
Just the second series to incorporate, you know, her and Valerie's character more because they don't appear in the second book. Can you talk at all about what the process is like adapting slightly different from the source material?
Sure. I mean, it's a very fine line because ultimately we are making an adaptation, so you want to make sure that we're true to the spirit of the book. And we've spoken with Deb at length, you know, because Deb knows her audience, you know, better than any of us. But the bottom line is that they are such an amazing couple, and you just want to spend way more time with them. So if there is a way to do that authentically that feels real to the novel, and also because of the really special relationship that Diana has with Sarah and Em, it feels like a really important, I think, you know, it's just something we feel we must explore for the audience as well, because it would be so disappointing getting to know these guys.
And there are so many amazing characters in the first season, and I assume the audience are going to fall in love with all these incredible characters. And it's funny because in season two, we kind of drop out and we don't see a lot of them again. So it would be fantastic to see how we can weave some of the characters into the second season.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing in the second season.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I don't know if you guys have read the novel yet. But of course. Okay. So you know it's Elizabethan, it's present. You know, so there's lots going on there.
Well, Teresa, what did you find some challenging parts of, if any, bringing Diana Bishop to life, and some surprising or inspiring, and did she change you?
Ah, beautiful question. One of the most challenging aspects is just, it's quite practical, I guess. She's a rower. I am not a rower. That was just one particular thing that I found challenging, but really rewarding once I got it. I grew up doing a lot of athletics, and I thought I'd be fantastic when I got in the boat. I didn't realize how unstable a single skull is. And I got in, and I remember Dan, my coach, was like, kind of move around a bit, and then all of a sudden went boom, and he quickly grabbed the boat, and he's like, well, you were about to go in. He's like, now you know what it is. And it was interesting because it was such an exercise in calming my mind, and as soon as I let fear come in and I was overthinking the process with the oars, it would start wobbling, and I actually found it quite meditative, and it carried me throughout the series because I thought about the way she is one with her boat and how therapeutic that is for her. And it became that for me as well. So it was definitely the most challenging aspect of it, but I would say by the end of the show, it might have been my favorite part of it.
More and more importantly today, we are focusing on strong female characters in TV, so it's wonderful to see Diana Bishop brought to life. What did you love most about her, and, you know, her relatable vulnerabilities and, you know, those sort of things? Because we all try to be badass all the time. So what were you most excited to show on screen to a female audience with this character?
Well, I just love females, and I think females can be everything. They can be strong and vulnerable. They don't have to be black and white. We are many colors, and we have lots of complexity to us. So I loved that she was brave and brilliant, and she was so determined, yet she had this vulnerability to her, and she was fearful to open up to this whole other side of herself that she'd been denying for so long, and it just made her feel very human, which is funny because she is from this other world. She's a witch, and I just related to her. I thought that it was beautiful that Deb wrote someone who was so layered and could be contradictory. She could be brave one moment and then vulnerable the next, and fall into, you know, a passionate way of feeling, but then stop herself. And I just thought she was just a beautiful, strong character to bring to life on screen. I kept falling deeper and deeper in love with her.
I think the one thing that I was really impressed with Teresa's performance and the way she's taken the character is just the fact that she does have a great integrity. As you know, she's badass, but she's also got integrity because she's a historian and she loves her work, she loves her studies, and having that integrity with the character is something I don't think you see that much on screen, because it's all about the badass element, but it's not always embracing who the character really is deep down. And it was so important to the novels that that we actually tackled that, and I think it's something that Therese has done fantastically well.
Wonderful. No,
we obviously hear a lot of it, and we heard a little bit about it in the panel with you, Teresa, kind of what drew you to this particular project. But I'm curious, as a producer, as someone who came on board to the project, was there something specific that drew you to this particular project?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think for me, the overall message of the novels and the trilogy, you know, being about acceptance, is such an important message to put out there. And I think on the panel, we were talking about the fact that in some ways the discrimination is between the species. It's not about race, it's not about sexuality. That was something that's really important, because it's something I don't think we talk enough about as a society. So for me, that was the real important aspect that drew me to the trilogy.
Yeah. Do you feel that this character taught you anything that you're walking away like, wow?
Yeah, I think my favorite part of her is when she has such an arc throughout season one. And when she sort of lets go and just embraces all the beautiful parts of who she is. She's really leaning into her authentic self. And I think whenever in my own life I get a little stuck, I always remind myself, just do as Diana does, lean into your authentic version of yourself, into your truth, because it will always serve you. If you always fall back on your truth, it will serve you. And I think just delving into a character who... she has nothing but that, like, as you get further along in the series. It was so, what a gift to have. And so she taught me that, I think.
Lachlan, tell us about the process of, before you even get to the scripts and before you get to, or as you go to the casting, etc., going from book to all the scripts. So where does the number of 8 episodes come from? And then once you get that number, how do you even start breaking down such a book into where to break it, what to maybe leave out or change or adapt, etc.?
I guess work with the best people in one respect, because, you know, Jane Tranter, who runs Bad Wolf, you know, she has just got the most incredible instinct for story, and very quickly we arrived at the 8 episodes. And Kate Brooke, who was our lead writer on the show, she came on board and then started breaking down, you know, what the key story beats that we would hit in each episode. And then we bring on the writing team. And at the same time, you know, Jane's always across the creative process with the story. So in some, but it's a bit yin and yang as well, because I think it's important that in terms of the timeline, you're generally still developing the scripts. Even, you know, once the series has been commissioned, you'll have a map of where you want to take it, but you won't have worked it through to the nth degree. So it's all quite an organic process.
So this is more of a fun question. Now, obviously, we know that Diana is a witch in the story, but, you know, I think having had a chance to learn all of the mythology and history and all the different creatures, you personally, I mean, this question is for both of you, which group would you have chosen to be?
Witch.
As in witch, vampire, demon.
He's demon. He has lots of hair. So. I think witch, just obviously because it's what I know and it's what I've been living as this character. I don't. I love the journey that Matthew goes on, but I don't relate to it as much as I relate to Diana. So for me, I think it's a no-brainer. I would choose witch. I love her powers. I love just that whole world. Demons are an interesting kind.
Yeah. The thing is...
mad.
Yeah, it sounds a bit of a cop-out to say it's both, but I guess, I'm fascinated by demons because they are... the people who are on the fringes of society, they're the cleverest people out there, whether they be investment bankers or artists. They're the real creative types within our world. But it is a very fine line because you have the rock stars, but you also have the serial killers. So just knowing where you fit into that. So,
yeah, where do you fit into that?
We recently interviewed at Pure Fandom Alice Trotton, who
directed
for our Fierce Female series, and she was talking about how we asked her, you know, what was it very important for you as a woman to really showcase, you know, the strengths of female character and all those sorts of things, and that dove into the special effects and like how do we show that with your powers.
Yeah.
So was it more, you dove into a little bit in the panel, but was it a lit? Did you find it more mechanical filming those special effects scenes? Or was it
really fun?
Yeah.
But because we use a lot of practical effects, so I was on a lot of wires. So for any of the stuff where I needed to be off the ground, I'll try not to give anything away. Yeah. I was doing wire work, which is really fun. We had some green screen stuff. It is technical, so you do have to hit certain beats and certain places because of where the camera is located, and also if we were using any CGI, there was always a CGI expert there to say, look, you can go here but not here, you can have this kind of movement but not this kind of movement. So sometimes it was a little bit more mechanical, but mostly it was just fun.
But I think it was a bit more organic, certainly from what I'm watching when I'm watching Rushes, it was a bit more organic than that, because I think with any scene there's always a shape to it, and it's the same with VFX, it's just the rules are slightly different. So I do think that there is a technical side to it, but you're always trying to ground it in authenticity, and because of the way we focused on trying to do, as Tracy was saying about doing as much of it practically rather than relying on VFX, it meant that it felt grounded and part of our world, which is
You could still be immersed in your character whilst being on a rig or whilst having to hit a certain mark. I think our crew and just the passion of the actors really help create that environment where you can stay in character. Even though there may be huge set pieces and things going around you, you really just sort of immerse yourself in the world and then you stay in there.
So, what do you think about that, Sam? That was a pretty full All Souls Comic-Con.
Like I said, I didn't say it in this podcast, but I said it on the other podcast that if Deb looked out into the audience at every panel she was a part of, and if she looked down into the audience at the center and then over three chairs to her right, that's where I sat at every panel. I don't know how it happened. I don't know how I lucked into that seat, but I'm sure I was the stalker of Comic-Con.
And as Deb has told and other media have reported, Deb received a surprise award at that panel. It was a solo panel, right? It was just her?
It was just her and one of her former
thesis
students who now works at Entertainment Weekly. Her name is Maureen. I think it's Lanker. Maureen Lanker. Let me double check.
What a special panel to have, special for the interviewer to be able to speak to one of her, to someone who is such a success and the stature, et cetera, of Deb, but also someone who was one of your mentors from your history. I mean, how amazing would that be for someone to be able to interview one of their mentors? And then vice versa, how amazing would it be for Deb to not only be in the very caring hands as an interviewee, being the very caring hands of a former student whom you helped mentor, and mold, et cetera, and shape and or affect for her future. And then to be given on top of that, this amazing award, the surprise of this award, the Inkblot Award.
At this Comic-Con alone, I witnessed two of them be awarded. One was to Nichelle Nichols, who was the original Lieutenant Uhura.
But that was a lifetime achievement something, right? That wasn't an
Inkblot? No, it was not. That was an Inkblot.
So they're all Inkblots are
outstanding. It's like the Oscars. There's a bunch of different categories.
Got it. Okay.
So I'm sure hers was living legend category, whereas Deb's was outstanding achievement in whatever style of fiction, whatever. I don't remember what her title was. I'm sure Deb knows. I'm sure she looks at it lovingly and caresses it every day.
Congratulations, Deb, on your award, on the amazing week that was not your first Comic-Con, but what truly can be called the first All Souls Comic-Con. It was such an exciting time for the All Souls fandom, just to be able to watch and see all the stuff that was happening. And it was so exciting. So we're so happy. Thank you guys so much for joining us. And we hope you've enjoyed our interviews and the roundtables, the press roundtables. And it was so much fun. We hope to be able to do that again. So thank you guys so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode, in which we will return we promise, finally, again, to our Discovery Witches read-along, because it's already recorded and edited. We just had to take a little bit of a detour to get up some interviews and Comic-Con stuff. So thank you guys so much. We will be back after All Souls Con.